Shabbat shalom, everyone. The Father is so, so good. I want to testify to something real quick before we get started in this. You know, me and the wife was just praying in the parking lot because on the way here, for some reason, I do not know what reason, or maybe actually I do know, my mind started up spiritually and physically this time. I had a migraine like there was no tomorrow. I had nothing but, you're going to forget, you're going to this, you're going to that, all the stuff. But praise Yah, because He reminds us of what authority we operate in, what authority we are able to receive from the one that points us into the right direction, so that way we can draw near to Him. Amen. And give Him all the praise and the glory that He so deserves. The Father is good to us. You know, there's a beautiful thing about Genesis chapter 46 and the fact that it really does emphasize Yah's divine provision and preservation. And we're going to continue to look at that because the Father's good to us. He is so good to us. Amen. And we're going to begin the text off on verse 28. You know, maybe that might be me avoiding have to read the phone book of names that we have there, because that can be challenging sometimes. But before we start to dive into it, you know, sometimes we can convince ourselves that a message might just be too simple, especially for seasoned vets. But it's the reality of the fact that He makes His words simple. Right. And it makes us so wise if we're willing to apply ourselves directly to it. And I just want to emphasize again about how thankful I am about that verse 28 and the way that Almighty Yah showed us through past His word and from what we wouldn't been able to share throughout the week about it. Because we do need direction. And I wanted to share. I'm surprised I didn't share this during Bible study. About directions, about instructions, about how important they are. Because I had my own test trial run. I called a pastor and I told him whenever it came Sunday. Yeah, I still was not feeling well. But I had to say, oh well, because I had a hot water heater leaking in my house, apparently for a lot longer than what I thought. And I was getting some cool looking hippy dippy stain on the side of my house. That's one kind of water stain that you just don't want, especially when it's showing on the outside. You know it's been kind of saturating. But anyway, it was a bit of a process. It was definitely a bit of a process, especially whenever it's a 50-gallon water tank. And then you have to learn that you have to really apply the instructions part about patience, because it was being tested, especially when you open that bad boy to drain it out, and it's just drip, 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 drip. I'm like, well, the guy on the video said it might take a while, so you just let it drip, drip. Then an hour turned into 2 hours, and then I was starting to realize, well, the sun is about to set. I'm not feeling well. It's kind of chilly. We got to get this thing on a roll. And let me tell you, the Sawzall is a multi-tool of all. Cut the nozzle off. I shoved it into the hole, turned it on. And they had a lot of water come out, and I'm just thankful that the wife wasn't there for that part, because I had to clean up a lot of water out the laundry room. But we got it taken care of. So I'm just thankful that the process worked. I had to remodel the inside of it. I had to cut out, you know, non-essential frames, and I mean that confidently, that nothing's going to fall in the house. So I'm definitely convincing people tonight not to let me do any handiwork at their house, huh? No, but thankfully it's a modular home, so it's got enough staples and nails to hold together a Home Depot if it wanted to. So, but I'm thankful for that, because during that process, I literally needed the word that went forth, and I'm glad I listened to it beforehand, because how important instructions are. Because when you're playing around with hot water heaters, you could really, really, things can go really bad, really south, really quick. And there's a couple of little hiccups here and there, but Thankfully, you can always go back to the instructions and rely on the path that the Father's trying to establish in your life, so that way he can restore you to functionality. And you know, when I had one of them moments, I call it the, I guess, still a coined term that Pastor used once before, and I'm being reminded of, a rob verb. And you kind of just meditate on certain things, and a simple water heater can turn into a whole lesson, because I began to look at that water heater and I started thinking about its functionality, about its purpose, about how important it is for it to fill completely up with water, and it's going to distribute that water that's been given to it into the rest of the house, so that way it could be used to cleanse, just like his word fills us up, and we're to distribute it to the house and provide the opportunity for cleansing. But none of it's possible without the power being supplied to it, so you can have the hot water. That's its function. Because there's a uniqueness about hot water that allows us to be able to cleanse a lot more efficiently. And then it reminded me that that water heater has an occupation. It has its job. We have occupation. And we're going to look at that tonight. We're going to look at the occupation that's been laid out before us. Let's get into the word before I go into another project story. Well, I'm going to go ahead and read down to 34. And tonight is not extensive of all the verses there. And I'm sure there's plenty to be built off. But I'm going to point out what the Father was dealing with me personally for us tonight. It says, verse 28, and he sent Yehuda before him to Joseph to point out before him the way to Goshen. And they came to the land of Goshen. And Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. And he appeared to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. And Israel said to Joseph, let me die, since I have seen your face, that you are still alive. And Joseph said to his brothers and his father's household, I am going to inform Pharaoh and say to him, my brothers and those of my father's house who were in the land of Canaan have come to me, and the men are shepherds, that they have been men of livestock. And they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And it shall be when Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? That you shall say, your servants have been men of livestock from our youth even till now, both we and also our fathers, so that you dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Mishraites. And that's what we're going to be looking at. We're going to be looking at shepherds, occupation, and then we're going to end it off with the reason why every shepherd is an abomination to the Mishraites, which naturally is going to be a review because we've once had that before. But it's kind of neat how it all fits into these three verses. I haven't seen it before in this light. But I want to just get right into this in dealing with shepherds. So I thought this was pretty unique, especially due to the fact that we just had that ordination. And to the fact that this can directly apply to how important it is to make sure that you're walking within the standards of what that occupation calls for. Because realistically, we heard it last Shabbat whenever it comes to us being able to receive the directions so that way we can draw near. And I can't help but notice that what Pastor Chad was dealing with is the continuation of the realization that if we gravitate towards that tree, we cannot just only get ourselves in a whole lot of trouble, but those that we are responsible for. And we can see that throughout the history of the kings and the prophets. Time and time again, we see the examples right there in front of us on how important it is for us to make sure that we're drawing from the source of life. And the source of life points us in the right direction so that way we can draw near. He wants us to succeed. And, you know, I enjoyed the different lessons that the Father was dealing with me on a personal note. Because anytime I've had any place of occupation, whenever I was working with for Pastor, and whenever I was out and about helping different people with random jobs here and there, which I'm glad I had practice for, especially when it comes to my own home. And I'm glad people trust me. But needless to say, especially whenever I go into the parish, wherever it may be, you're entering into an occupation that's going to have a set of rules to follow that's going to direct you to be successful in whatever it is that you're applying yourself to. And naturally, in my cases at least, I've had higher-ups. I've had people to draw from, to receive the instructions. And the best way to respect somebody that's giving instructions is to receive them with a heart willing to do them and not feel like you need to add to them, which I get to hear a lot of. That's why I'm smiling, because we get the big case of, well, that ain't my job. I ain't doing that. You want me to do what? Who? Where? When? And it continues on, because when you get to the flesh, it'd be asking all them questions. I'm not going to sing that's a song from way back. But whatever, yeah, I know. I need to leave it alone, because we might end up singing Hank Williams. But I'm going to move on. I'm going to move on from that. But it's important for us to make sure that we know exactly what it is that we are required of to be able to be the shepherds the Father expects us to be. Because you could receive a title, you could receive an occupation, but it's absolutely 100% up to you if you want to walk out the way the Father recommends it. Because we still got free will. And I personally want to make sure that I allow the directions to direct me, not my emotions, not my convictions, because those can be manipulated, but instead the Father's word that's concrete and true and steadfast, and that's going to lead us to our ability to draw near. But I wanted to read this to y'all because I thought this was pretty neat. I was looking at different things that really emphasize the heart of a shepherd. I'm going to read this to y'all. But this says, a spiritual look at the heart of a shepherd is about having a heart that reflects Jehovah's own care, protecting, guiding, and sacrificially loving people the way a good shepherd cares for sheep. You know, when I first read that, you know, there's sometimes a shepherd is dealing with a sheep, and that sheep might bite. That sheep might start acting up. That sheep might make a mess on itself. That sheep might act a certain kind of way, but that doesn't change the requirements of what's required of that shepherd to distribute the correct love and care. And that's probably easy for someone that can be considered very young in the ministry in comparison to those that's been doing this for a long time. And I think about that, and I'm just thankful. And I just want to take that moment to just be thankful to the Father for y'all, because there's things that y'all have gone through that y'all probably haven't even shared with people. And it takes a special kind of heart. And if this is a word tonight, just to be of encouragement, then just know it's of the Father. And I aim to be able to deliver what word he has for me to his liking. But in Scripture, this model for Jehovah's heart, Yeshua's ministry, and the kind of heart spiritual leaders and believers are called to develop. Core spiritual qualities. Spirituality, a shepherd's heart is marked by deep compassion that notices people who are harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd, and moves toward them with help and comfort. It is also sacrificial, following Yeshua, the good shepherd who lays his life down for his sheep and puts their well-being ahead of personal comfort or rights. A shepherd-hearted person knows people by name, listens to their struggles, and offers wise guidance instead of harsh condemnation. A shepherd's heart protects others from harm or false influences, warns when someone is drifting and works to restore the hurting or wandering rather than giving up on them. Spiritually, the heart of a shepherd is humble and accountable, seeing leadership as a calling from Yehovah rather than a position of status. It feeds others with the truth, stays faithful in hard seasons, and looks to Yehovah as the true chief shepherd while serving under his authority. And I thought this was also interesting because it's not just for leadership, it's for everyone. We all have our own responsibility of people that the Father has entrusted us in our lives to be able to shepherd in the way that he sees. But this is for everyone. The shepherd heart is not only for pastors, but anyone who cares for others, parents, mentors, friends, can embody it practically. That means noticing needs, setting aside time and energy to serve, standing guard against what harms souls, and leading others gently toward Yehovah's healing and hope. And that was just a small excerpt that I went and looked at. And I was thinking about that, and I was meditating upon that. And I'm thankful. I'm thankful for what the Father's been able to personally do in my life. Because honestly, I'm going to just be honest, because according to the world standards, I just thought I was a sissy. Because I cared entirely too much about people and their well-being and just trying to be there for people. But the entire time, it was because the Father gave me at birth a sensitive heart that the world has tried to callous and was at one point very successful. But I'm thankful that the Father has created in us a heart that's willing to be able to serve, that's willing to be able to be shepherds in a place that don't like shepherds, in a world that don't like shepherds. Because I'm alluding to that fact that Yosef said, this is what you're going to say to Pharaoh, in a land where they don't like us at all. And as we know, they Semites. And it's a beautiful operation that the Father put into plan. And he's always working behind the scenes for each and every one of us, but we have to be willing to walk in the direction that he calls us. And that's me kind of getting ahead of myself. But shepherd, the Strong's, for those taking notes, is H7462, and it's Ra'ah. I'm not going to read the whole Strong's definition, but it's to tend a flock, that is to pasture it. The ancient Hebrew, these are very straightforward explanations. Its parent root is the resh in the ayin. The pictograph of the resh is a picture of a head of a man, and the ayin is the picture of an eye. Combined, these means man watches. The shepherd closely watched over his flock. Often, they are his only companions. You know, there was a point in my, and I just want to share this, but there was a point in my life where I felt completely outcasted and forgotten about. And I'm thankful that the Father led me into a position to where I was a part of this flock, and I am a part of this flock. Because at one point, you know, we're my only companions. In the meantime, the Father was dealing with my personal issues so that way I can regain those that I've lost. But the He, the Ayin, and the Resh is the Ra'ah. And it's to feed, to pasture, and desire. One who provides and protects the flock and takes desire in them. And it's the HV. So it's mainly emphasizing to feed, to provide feed or pasture to the flock. You also, what I find interesting about this in consideration of where they're at and when they're at, because it's still during the time of this great famine. And pastors, shepherds, are responsible, whether there's a famine or not, to still feed the flock, to be in a position to be able to administer and give the word in a world that could be plagued with a famine of the word. And that could be literally our position. We have to make sure that we're willing to step into that and walk in that in a way that people are able to receive what it is that they need within the time frame that they need it. Shabbat shalom, y'all. Some of y'all thought I was in a service right there. But these are different things to reflect on. And when dealing with shepherd, I was thankful that this came back to memory whenever I was meditating on where to go. Because honestly, whenever we look at the links to where each and every time certain words are mentioned, you could have a whole list and a half and a list and a half and a list and a half. But if you spend time in a word, the Father will remind you of a certain word that you know that these words exist in already. Hallelujah. You go to Psalms 23. It's the only way we're going to know how to shepherd properly over our homes, our household, over the flock, is if we look to the one that shepherds perfectly. Jehovah is my shepherd. I do not lack. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. And I want to take a moment real quick before I continue in that on the I do not lack. The reality of the fact is that we could be in the middle of the most worst scenario that we could potentially be going through. But we truly do not lack if we have the Father. That's why we do not lack. I remember the moments and the times I was homeless. I remember when I didn't have, barely squat, didn't have a cell phone, I had a truck. I was living out that thing at Joshua's Marina. So on and so forth, as I've shared before, living in a shipping container, working for a foreign guy named Mr. Danny. Still don't know his real name. And just, I did not feel the entire time. Like I've said before, I've been homeless before in the past, and it was miserable. But when I had the Father through those moments, it's not bad at all. I was still seeing sunshine and rainbows. When I mean sunshine, he was lighting my path, and rainbows, he gave me a covenant to hold on to. And he is so good to us. He is so good to us. But we won't lack if we truly allow him to shepherd our lives, to point us in a direction. He makes me lie down in green pastures. That can represent in areas of comfort to where we could receive nourishment and truth. He leads me beside still waters. He brings us to places to where we can cleanse ourselves and be able to enter into covenant with him. He turns back my being, and we know that in this wonderful Hebraic understanding. He gives us the ability to turn back. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Only his ways are right. And when I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. And when we realize it, Yeshua, our Messiah, is both that rod and staff. The rod was used to prod sheep whenever they needed motivation to go the right direction. He chastises those that he loves. And though sometimes it may feel like too much, he knows what enough is for us. And then there's sometimes we really start to act the fool. We might start jumping around and getting a little fleshy and crazy. Then all of a sudden we're bouncing around and we landed in a big old thorn bush called sin. That's where that staff with the hook comes in. Because I can guarantee you right now, he ain't jumping in the thorn bush. He ain't jumping in your sin to get you out of sin. But he'll extend that loving chesed, that kindness and mercy to get you out of the situation that we get ourselves in each and every time. And if anything's praiseworthy, that's a praiseworthy thing because the Father's good to each and every one of us. And also, to be fair, the Ra's there to protect us from the wolves, from those seeking to devour and tear each and every one of us up. Because a good old pop on the head helps that out. You spread before me a table in the face of my enemies. And that verse will never be the same for me, as I've shared before. I was reading over this through a time that I was really struggling mentally. And the Father, within that moment, gave me a vision of me sitting at the table, and across from me, a mirror dropped down in front of me. Because the reality is, sometimes our biggest enemy is the enemy within me. It's what we say and allow and do to get into our minds, that the Father has to remind us that he is much greater than us, and he's here to help each and every one of us to make sure that we succeed. Sometimes he has to remind us because we forget. You have anointed my head with oil. My cup runs over. And I'm thankful. I'm thankful for the anointing. I wanted to share. There's something about that anointing that really, really impacted me. And I wasn't expecting. It was the anointing of the backbone. So I need it. There's times where I allow this to be in moments where I really need to speak up. Because the reality is, whether we like to hear it or not, there's doctrine out there that we're responsible to be against. But how we handle it is really reflective of if we're walking in the right character or not. I had a situation yesterday. And I'm thankful that I was in the area that I was currently in for it. Because I'm not going to name names because of the certain things that I'm going to mention about the conversations. But sitting at work, we're sitting at the table, and when you work for the parish, sometimes you have a little extra downtime, shocker, and you get time to speak to one another. I was asked a question about the ordination. Hey, so is congratulations in order? Because I think you mentioned something about a ordination. I was like, it happened. Like, oh, okay, so are you a rabbi? And I wanted to usually pull the first joke that I've always done is, well, I can't be until I get my hat back from the Pope. You know, that's usually the first joke, because then I get people thinking, like, well, yeah, he actually does wear a yarmulke. Like, so, but anyway, I didn't that time. I was just like, oh, I said, there's one true rabbi. I said, I am a minister. I am a shepherd. I'm a pastor. But I said, whenever it comes to titles, let my fruit bear instead of just saying. Of course, in their fashion, it was like, well, now that you mention it, you actually really kind of don't have the moments where you get real aggravated with the stuff anymore and all that. So I just wanted to congratulate you on that, too. That he said, the oil and all that must have really worked. I was like, man, you talk about stuff before, but all right, I appreciate it. But then more questions start to arise about things, because now we're on the topic of these things. And I'm going to spare certain parts, but I'm going to fast forward to my point. Is Trinitarianism got brought up? Because, you know, well, I like this part before it got to that. You know, actually, I kind of like the direction y'all are going over there anyway, because let's be real. We know that Christ is a Jew. He's Jewish. He comes from them. I mean, well, it makes sense to actually look at where he comes from. Like, oh, yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And he's like, well, yeah, what do you think about the Trinitarianism? I think they got some good stuff in there that we should, consider.
I said, well, this is where we're going to pump our brakes and park the truck, and we're going to have a little talk. Because I said, you know, realistically, if we just kept it on a common sense level, the word does not support that language in any way, shape, or form. I said, we could take things and hurry up and run with it and be like, oh, well, he said, if you see me, you've seen the Father. I say, have you ever acted like your daddy before? Yeah, that's a good point. You say, well, you kind of mentioned it. I mean, this is someone that's not really strongly rooted in doctrine, obviously, but you can tell by the conversation that I'm having. You say, well, you know, now that you say it, it really don't make sense whenever it says he's seated at his Father's right hand. I mean, I've never seen anybody sit at their own right hand. I said, no, you have to be on the left side to be able to sit at the right. So it's not possible. Kind of chuckled and we moved on from it. But there were certain moments in my past where if anything would have got brought up, and because I would have thought maybe I'm not equipped enough, I don't know enough, I can't tell you about what Constantine's favorite sandwich was back and so on and so forth, you know, all the details yet, because I'm required to have an answer for all things, so I'm not making a little Constantine sandwich joke because, like, it's not important. It's important. The facts about Constantine, not the sandwich. But for us to be able to have an answer for all things, I would have just kept my mouth shut and been like, all right, I'm gonna just let them think what they want. That's not the right approach. So I was thankful for that moment and didn't blow up out of proportion or anything of that sort. And the Father is able to get each and every one of us in a position to where our cup runs over with the anointing and to be able to trust this process. But we're in Psalms 23. And since I had that side detour, being that it's only 6 verses, I'm going to start back from the top and read verse number 6. But Jehovah is my shepherd, I do not lack. He makes me lie down in green pasture. He leads me beside still waters. He turns back my being. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. When I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. For you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they shall comfort me. You spread before me a table in the face of my enemies. You have anointed my head with oil. My cup runs over. Only goodness and loving commitment, chesed, follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of Jehovah to the length of days. And I want you to keep something in mind, that chesed and the house of Jehovah. Because he has a house of loving kindness. He has a house of chesed, which we're going to make our way to. That's so important to realize what authority we are to operate in as shepherds and shepherdesses, as people that are responsible for people in our lives to make sure that they're being led and directed down a path to be able to draw near to the Father. But before we get there, and I'm going to have to do the summary option, there's a warning for shepherds. In Ezekiel chapter 34, and I'm going to leave it up to y'all to read the details. I did find a source that summarizes it and encapsulates it in its entirety, but it's always good to go through the details to make sure that we know the fine details of what the Father says. But I'm just going to tell you about it, and I'm going to, for the sake of time, because I'm realizing the time, I'm going to give a summary of Ezekiel 34, the warning to shepherds. It says, Ezekiel 34 exposes Israel's leaders as selfish shepherds who use the people instead of caring for them, causing the flock to be scattered and vulnerable. Jehovah declares judgment on the corrupt shepherds and promises to personally step in as a true shepherd to rescue, gather, heal, and protect his people. And we know whenever it says that he is going to step in, we know that it's going to be our Messiah, the good shepherd, that steps in on his behalf to do exactly what it is that the Father needed to do. Jehovah condemns leaders who feed themselves rather than the flock, ignoring the weak, sick, injured and lost because of this failure, Yehovah removes them from their role and holds them accountable for the harm done to his people. Yehovah promises to search for his scattered sheep, bring them back, give them good pasture, and make them rest in safety. He also promises to judge between the fat and the lean sheep. In other words, the oppressors and the oppressed. And to set up one faithful shepherd from David's line over them, pointing to a future messianic ruler, Yeshua Messiah. And that was a summary, because I definitely did have the entire 31 verses lined up, ready to go through. But we really need to get the encapsulation of what it is that we're looking at. So before we continue forward and shepherd and breaking that word down and looking at the details of that, we also have occupation. Now, this is probably going to be one of those quick breakdowns, because it's one of them situations where whenever pastor says, do you want me to tell you what the word occupation means in Hebrew? Occupation. It means what it means. And that's how it kind of looks whenever you're looking at the description of this one. Right, H4639. Ma asay. I've been practicing that one. But it's an action, transaction, product, property. It means to work, to labor. In this ancient Hebrew, it's probably the shortest one I've ever seen. It's to do. That's what it says, do. Work. The making or doing of anything. To do, make something a generic verb with a wide application, meaning to do something. So literally, occupation means occupation. It's work. It's what you do. Now we have to operate in a certain authority whenever it comes to the position of that occupation as shepherds. And we're going to look at that example of authority by the one that points in the right direction by looking at the Greek equivalent of occupation. It gives you G2041, ergon, which also means the same thing, work, occupation. It's equivalent. Let's make our way to John chapter 5. Where we could see our good shepherd at work and the authority that the Father gives him. And I want you to keep in mind what we were just speaking about a house of Hesed. Verse 1, after this, there was a festival of the Yehudim, and Yeshua went up to Yerushalayim, and in Yerushalayim, at the sheep gate, which, if I remember correctly, is northeast. And I recommend, if anyone hasn't already, spend some time in Nehemiah, because chapter 3 speaks about the specifics of the gates and the rebuilding of the walls. I thought that was interesting. But let's continue on this. There is a pool, which is called, in Hebrew, Beth Zatha, or whenever you break it down, could also be Beth Chesed, the house of kindness at the sheep gate. Almost sounds just like Psalms 23. But having five porches, and these were lying a great number of those who were sick, blind, crippled, paralyzed, waiting for the stirring of the water. Now, realistically, we know this could also be a spiritual application here, because there's plenty of people that are spiritually sick, spiritually blind, spiritually crippled, spiritually paralyzed, and spiritually waiting for a stirring to happen in their life so that way they can be able to walk and be healed and complete and full. But only by the authority of our Messiah that these healings can take place. Before a messenger was going down, this is explaining the process of why they're waiting in this certain position. For a messenger was going down at a certain time into the pool and was stirring the water. Whoever stepped in first, not all that stepped in, whoever stepped in first, kind of gives you that realization of like, you better be on the edge of the pool or able to be. And there were some that weren't able to be. After the stirring of water became well of whatever disease he had. And a certain man was there who had a sickness 38 years. When Yeshua saw him lying there and knowing that he already had been a long time, he said to him, "Do you wish to become well?" I can't help but realize and remember the time that I really needed to hear them words from him. And that's the love of a good shepherd. Because each and every one of us, we didn't know how to walk in this. We didn't know how to walk. We were sick. But he saw us where we're at, and he asked us, "Do you wish to be well?" We got to be in a position to where we make sure we hear from him. The sick man answered him, "Master, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred. But while I am coming, another stepped down before me." And Yeshua said to him, "Rise, and take up your bed and walk." And immediately the man became well, and he took up his bed and was walking. Now it was Sabbath on that day. The Yehudim, therefore, said to him who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. It is not right for you to take up the bed." He answered them, "He who made me well said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" Therefore they asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" But the one who was healed did not know who it was, for Yeshua had moved away, a crowd being in that place. Afterward, Yeshua found him in a set apart place. And I just want to say, this is also a small detail, but it's very important. After you receive that miracle, after you receive that healing, after you receive that breakthrough, you should be found in a set apart place. Because if you're not, right here, you're going to see what happens if you're not, or if you turn your back on that. Because it's subtle, but if you look at it, it'll hit you. And said to him, "See, you have been made well. Sin no more, so that no worse matter befalls you." So that what? No worse matter befalls you. Sin no more. Now, I remember listening, because homie was sick at home whenever the message went forth. I was listening and remembering about the part of the process of how important it is to understand that Yarah, the word Yarah, is the primitive root. It is what we would call on the streets the OG. And whenever you're looking at the word Torah, instructions to point, to hit your mark, it's so that way we sin no more. And I always thought that was interesting, how that was something part of archery, that whenever you missed your mark, sin! But sometimes things are just right there in plain sight. If we're willing to see it, we can receive it. But it's important to make sure that we're in a set-apart place, because if we're not in a set-apart place, we wouldn't receive the direction of not and how to not sin no more. So that way, worse doesn't befall us. That is the rod and the staff comforting us. Pulls us out of the situation and mess that we're in, heals us, and then also nudges us to go in the right direction. Remember, and tonight is all about encapsulating the occupation of a shepherd. The man went away and told the Yehudim that it was Yeshua who made him well. Now, when a man did that, at first I was like, you little tattletale. But realistically, they probably didn't make their intentions known to him. So we can't blame the man. I think that's just an older brother of six kind of feeling. The man went away and told the Yehudim that it was Yeshua who made him well. And because of this, the Yehudim persecuted Yeshua and were seeking to kill him because he was doing these healings on the Sabbath. But Yeshua answered them, "My Father works until now, and I work." I'm sure they loved that answer. But I put a little note in here. I had a moment where I was sitting there thinking. It says, they hated him because his walk showed a character they lacked. The character of Yah. When you think about it, the Semites also were hated for having a different character trait than the Egyptians. Now, I'll put that in there, and I'm resonating, and I'm thinking about the two time frames, the differences, the different groups and people, and the different things happening and taking place. The only same thing over a span of thousands of years that remains the same is spiritual matters. And there's things that may seem new to us because we've been here but yet a vapor, but these things have been going and continuing in the same direction. And I was also reminded that whenever we choose to have friendship with the world, in other words, enjoy the ways of the world, we have enmity with Elohim. We got to make sure that we're on the right side of things, because if we're not careful, we could end up in a position to where we're not realizing that our words that are coming out of our mouth in regards to what people are doing that may be being orchestrated by Almighty Yah is by the hand of Almighty Yah, and we be mindful to never be in a self-righteous religious mind state that may get things twisted. In other words, if I had to apply all that of what I just said into an example, it could be something as simple as, it could be a high Sabbath, a Sabbath, and we putting up and taking down a tent. You know, somebody could start tripping over something like that, because to them in their mind, that's work. But let's be real. If the Father didn't smite the Levites and so on and so forth, and all those that had to do certain things that were required 1 through 7 days of the week, because the Father's work never stops, because there's a process of cleansing and healing, where do we draw the fine line? John 5, I'm on verse 18. But because of this, then the Yehudim were seeking all the more to kill him. Because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, this is in air quotes, this is their reasoning. Because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he also called Elohim his own father. And according to them, making himself equal with Elohim. Well, you remember how I said earlier about authority? Yeshua and Yeshua-like fashion is about to lay out the real, true, genuine process of what authority looks like and what it's operated in. And if anything, it does also help whenever you're discussing matters of those that believe that the three are one. I don't mean to make a joke, but every time I hear that, it reminds me of shepherd's pie. I don't know if y'all ever had that, or call it something different. But that's the only three-in-one I really know about. But therefore, Yeshua responded and said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son is able to do none at all by himself, but only that which he sees the Father doing, because whatever he does, the Son also likewise does. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself does and greater works." Occupation. Ergon. "Than these he is going to show him in order that you marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and makes alive, even so the Son makes alive whom he wishes. For the Father judges no one, but has given all the judgment to the Son, that all should value the Son even as they value the Father. He who does not value the Son does not value the Father who sent him. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my words and believes in him who sent me possesses everlasting life and does not come into judgment, but has passed from death into life. Truly, truly, I say to you, the hour is coming and now is when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of Elohim, and those having heard shall live. For as the Father possesses life in him, so he gave also to the Son to possess life in himself. And he has given him authority also to do judgment, because he is the son of Adam. Do not marvel at this, because the hour is coming in which all in those tombs shall hear his voice, and shall come forth those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and to those who practice evil matters to a resurrection of judgment. Now, I can't help but remember a certain part of the conversation that I had left out with me and the individual. But in regards to that last verse I just read, you know, after we had our discussion about Trinitarianism, after we had our discussion about different things, about titles and some other stuff and whatnot, after a certain part, kind of reverted back to thinking, you know, just making wild jokes is funny. I said, or you could just always join the religion of heathenism and live it up until you're tired of living. I was like, okay, dude. And I was like, this is where I kind of draw the line. Like, I know you're just maybe trying to be on edge and trying to be funny, but realistically, do you realize what you just said? I said, honestly, you realize that you can have an opportunity at life everlasting, or you can convince yourself that you're actually going to get something from that, that you're actually going to get your something from the curse. And he kind of paused for a second, and you could tell I was being very serious, because that's the reality. It's as simple as that. The good that we do is from the authority of Almighty Yah, so that way we can actually obtain the resurrection. Or we can choose the latter end. Only our actions can honestly show forth the fruit that we were willing to bear. Verse 30. Of myself, I am unable to do any matter. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own desire, but the desire of the Father who sent me. If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. There is another who bears witness of me, and I know that the witness that which he bears of me is true. You have sent Yohanan, and he bore witness to the truth. But I do not receive witness from man, but I say this in order that you might be saved. He was the burning and shining lamp. For a while you wished to rejoice in his light, but I have a greater witness, that of Yohanan. For the works that the Father gave me to accomplish, the works that I do bear witness of me, that the Father has sent me. And the Father who sent me, he bore witness of me. You have neither heard his voice at any time nor seen his form. And you do not have his word staying in you, because you do not believe in him who he sent. You search the scriptures because you think you possess everlasting life in them. And these are the ones that bear witness of me. But you do not desire to come to me in order to possess life. I do not receive esteem from men, but I know you, that you do not have the love of Elohim in you. I have come in my Father's name, and you did not receive me. If another comes in his own name, you would receive him. How are you able to believe when you are receiving esteem from one another, and the esteem that is from the only Elohim you do not seek? Do not think that I shall accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moshe, in whom you have set your expectation. For if you believe Moshe, you would believe, have believed me since he wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how should you believe in my words? Purposely went through it so that way we can see in totality, in total, whenever it comes to Yeshua establishing his authority, recognizing and admitting and openly explaining that he can do nothing on his own, but every bit of authority that he has been established through the Father. And those that don't have eyes willing to see that the Father, throughout his instructions that we're directed to look at, to walk in, to trust, to be shepherded by, all points to him being able to be the one qualified to shepherd us. There's one more equivalent that we have to deal with, and that's shepherd. The Greek is G4166, and that's poimen. And I'm realizing we're short on time whenever it comes to me being able to also fit in the last part. But we're going to go ahead and go to John chapter 10. 1 through 98. No, I'm just joking. No, I'm sorry. 21. Y'all about ready to throw something at me, huh? No, it was a joke. I know y'all love me. But of course, as we were looking at, because we're looking at the standards of a shepherd, the authority that he operates in, the examples that we've been given, and in considering all of what was said, that we are able to enter into the sheep gate where his house of loving kindness, his chesed, is established, there's a shepherd that waits at the door. Now, mind you, as we have learned over the years, there's a significance between numbers because each Hebraic letter has a numeric value. And a dalet, so if you would just look at a doorway or any door, the frame, these doors, are an exact representation of what the letter dalet looks like. And that we know the Good Shepherd waits at the door. And I always thought this is absolutely incredible that we know Yehuda is the fourth son. The number four is the exact equivalent numeric value of dalet, the letter that represents the door that you can enter into and come out. So Yeshua, being the good shepherd that waits at the door, that came through the line of Yehuda, which I always thought was a praiseworthy thing. But John chapter 1, chapter 10, verse 1, and dealing with our good shepherd, says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter through the door into the sheepfold, but climbs up by another way, that one is a thief and a robber." Oh, Lord. Thought I was on the Red October. I thought Sean O'Connor was about to start popping out. We got to hunt for the Red October. What? Yeah, descending. I am Sean O'Connor. It's all good, brother. I'm a little on the quick side about movie jokes. Verse 2, "But he who enters through the door is the shepherd of the sheep. The doorkeeper opens for him, and the sheep hear his voice. And he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he has brought out his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice." They know his directions. "And they shall by no means follow a stranger, but shall flee from him because they do not know the voice of strangers." Now that kind of hit home whenever I was really meditating on the fact that dealing with the verse 28, excuse me, and realizing
that we have someone that points us into the right direction so that way we can draw near to the Father. And that direction being the Torah, that being the voice of Elohim that was echoed through Yeshua, the only way that we can truly say, whether people like it or not, that we know his voice is that we know the words that was spoken from his voice, the teachings that he would have taught and held fast to. Because we can never turn a blind eye to the fact of what Matthew chapter 7 says. We know that it begins with, do not judge, lest you be judged, for whatever judgment you measure out will be measured back. And then as you go further throughout the chapter, it starts to talk about the narrow path and the broad path. It also starts to talk about those that will say that they've done in my name. So on and so forth, that are representative of the fact that we need to be on the right direction, on the right path, listening to the right voice. Because God forbid we ever hear the words that ultimately say that you're going to be casted out into outer darkness. And that's why it's so important to make sure that we recognize his voice. So that way we also, those that take up the responsibility, that receive greater measure of judgment, that speak the words of the master, are also leading people in the right direction. And then it's up to them if they want to actually take those directions. Verse 6. Yeshua used this figure of speech, but they did not know what he had been saying to them. Yeshua therefore said to them again, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. Whoever enters through me, he shall be saved, and shall go in and shall go out and find pasture. The thief does not come except to steal, to slaughter, to destroy. I have come that they might possess life and that they might possess it beyond measure. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. But the hireling, and not being a shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees a wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf snatches the sheep and scatters them. Now the hireling flees because he is a hireling and not concerned about the sheep. And he reminds us again, I am the good shepherd, and I know mine, and mine know me. Even as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep, and other sheep I have are not of this fold, which are not of this fold, I have to bring them as well. They shall hear my voice, and there shall be one flock, one shepherd. And when I think about verse 16, it reminds me of what was brought up about Exodus, about that there's how many Torahs? One Torah. So we could also see it being applied in that sense, whenever those are that which are to come later on. We came later on into this. We're the strangers. We all get one Torah, one set of directions, one direction. Somehow I thought that was verse 21. Verse 15, even as the Father knows me and I know the Father and I lay down my life for the sheep and other sheep which are not of this fold, I bring to them as well. They shall hear my voice, and there shall be one flock, one shepherd. Because of this, the Father loves me, because I laid down my life in order to receive it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have the authority to lay it down. I have the authority to receive it again. This command I have received from my Father. Again, there came a division among the Yehudim because of these words. And many of them said, he has a demon and he is mad. Why do you listen to him?
And others said, "These are not the words of one possessed by a demon. Is a demon able to open the eyes of the blind?" There's one more thing we're going to look at before we close this out tonight. In Genesis 46, 34, it says something very specific that should always kind of give you like a little exclamation point of wondering, why would this be? And as I said earlier, it's a review for most of us, but this is something very important to historical context of what's taking place. Because it's all about the Father's providential care over his people. But it says in verse 34 that you shall say, "Your servants have been men of livestock from our youth even till now, both we and also our fathers, so that you dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Mishraites." And you would kind of get a little red flag there and wonder, okay, why? Well, there was a lot going on behind the scenes before Yosef was on the scene himself. And we're going to take a brief moment to look at the background of the dynasty during the 15th dynasty of the Egyptians that was Semitic, in a land of Mishraites. And it's all the providential care of the Father. It's the Hyksos. The history of the Hyksos era. But mind you, the Pharaoh during this time was Semitic and drew certain similarities to the ancestral lineage of the Hebrews. Because even though the Hebrews were Semitic, not every Semite was a Hebrew. There are certain things that they would have adapted to. Now, what I want to say, what I think is absolutely incredible to think about, is how the Father used them and inserted them in the way that he used them and inserted them to help the process of this whole restoration that's taken place and preservation that's taken place. And it also reminds me in the same way in shape and form, as Brother Chad was bringing up, that the Father can use Assyrians, Babylonians. He can use whatever and whoever to stir a direction, to put things into check, to put things into order, to protect us, to preserve us, because knowing that they would have to be, when I say they, I'm talking about the covenanted people, Yaakov, children of Israel, would have to be removed from the land of Canaan to avoid being immersed into their culture because it was more accepting, more open. Knowing that there would be a distaste for Semites in the land which they were being located to. Because during the 13th and the 14th dynasty era, of the Egyptians and the Pharaohs, they were having an economic collapse. So inflation was high, things were going bad and out of control, and then along comes a group of Semites from the Levant area, which would have been Syria, Israel, so on and so forth, as we know on the map. And they come along, and there's something real unique about these Semites. Because there is some Egyptian historians that said they came in with brute force, trying to make them seem non-intelligent. But the reality is, there's no historic findings or archaeological value to support that cause. But there is support that they literally inserted themselves among the culture, adapted to the culture, and then politically, with their brains, were able to basically over time convince them to give over control to the Semites. So it was a full political takeover. Like, whenever I think about that, I'm like, yo, like, let's be real. Most times whenever we deal with history,
It's because the other team had better weapons. These dudes straight up came in with their brains and their ability to be political. Well, it's something to be very honestly impressed about. Because let's be real, Egyptians were not really stupid people. They were very advanced in their craft. But they were also very prideful in their ability to produce crop. Because that's another key trait that separates the difference between a Semite and a Mishraite. Because the Mishraites took a lot of value. And you think about it like Cain and Abel, right? Because Cain was all about the crops. Abel was all about the livestock. Which I thought was absolutely phenomenal whenever you kind of look at the differences. But even according to ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, and I apologize for not being able to have it on a little presentation. I didn't have access to the iPad last minute like I wanted to. I should have done that yesterday. But anyway, I have it here if you want to see it after the service. But there are hieroglyphics that were found that kept record of these certain events taking place that show during the 15th dynasty, the majority of the hieroglyphics were people that would have been shepherding livestock. And it's really interesting to look at because in most of the other historical records of the Egyptians, it would have been mostly about their god, or gods, multiple, and the produce of livestock. Which also kind of highlights a really important thing whenever it comes to Pharaoh's dream when you think about it. Because what was used in the dream? Yes, cows, livestock, but also grain. And those, excuse me, you think about that, why both? It's because he would have been integrated in both cultures, that of his ancestors, the Semites, because this was not the only pharaoh. Their reign was for 108 years, which I ordered the book recently, so I'm going to get more details because I want to know about the extra pharaohs that would have been of Semitic background. But let me get into the details of it, of the Hyksos. So they ruled in Egypt for about 108 years. The Hyksos were a Semitic people who originated in the Levant region of the Mediterranean, which consists of Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel. They established their capital at Avaris, and the eastern delta ruled over the lower Egypt and the Nile Valley. Now, Avaris would be what we call true, like north on our compass, would be closer towards the Mediterranean area, off towards the northeast. But of course, as we learn over the years, the compass directions would have been different according to the Egyptians, just due to the fact that they went based off of the flow direction of the Nile River. But in other words, north was south, south was north, and so on and so forth. Remember the first time learning about that and looking into that, I was just like, yo, my poor brain. But we're dealing with the 15th dynasty, the Hyksos. And the Hyksos period consisted of from 1720 BCE to 1570 BCE. And we know that counting down is actually going up whenever it comes to this time period. But there were certain key events that was taking place in the background that I'm going to bring up during these years, that all this was taking place, that this takeover was taking place, and this is mainly targeted, and this is if you're taking notes or go back to the recording and listen. But it says, 1720, Jacob flees from Esau to Haran, which you can see in Genesis 27. And like I said, if you want to ask for the notes, so that way you can see the maps, I have maps of almost each and every historical part that's taking place. With 1700, even, Yosef is born to Jacob and Rachel, which you find that account in Genesis 30, 22. 1698, Jacob flees from Laban. You see in Genesis 30, chapter 31. 1683,
Joseph is sold as a slave into Egypt at 17 years old, which you find in Genesis 37:12. And I also have the map of the trade route that would have been taken from Avarius. It goes up from Avarius, the way of Shur to Beersheba, Hebron to Dothan, down to the way of the sea and back to Avarius would have been the trade route. With 1672, Joseph is falsely accused in Genesis 39 at about 28 years old, and then he spends 2 years in prison, which we remember during that time frame, it was pretty significant due to the fact that Potiphar's wife, with her nonsense and her lies, also pointed out within her lie, and you brought this Hebrew into this home to embarrass us. So obviously that's a little shade thrown towards the Semitic direction, because there would have been a lot of cultural and physical similarities between the two. 1670, Joseph is appointed vicar to the Hyksos Pharaoh at the age of 30. And we see that in Genesis 41, verse 46. And just the source where I got this information from is Bruce Gore. And I just recently ordered his book, The Historical Chronological Context of the Bible. And what it does is it gives you exact key scriptural details surrounding of what was going on in the political environment in the ancient nations, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Mishraites, all those that were directly involved with certain events in the scriptures. But in the future, the Hyksos were eventually expelled from Egypt by the pharaohs who recaptured their territory. The pharaoh Ahmose, founder of the 18th dynasty, ended the Hyksos rule when he defeated the Hyksos pharaoh Apophis at Ervis around 1521 BCE. Some interesting notes is their records of the rule was greatly disregarded by the Egyptians. Shocker. Also, their hieroglyphics showed that they were master herders and shepherds, which would have been looked down upon by the Egyptian standards, for they took more pride in their ability to produce crops instead of dealing with livestock. Which, of course, now I'm realizing that these interesting notes were already said. And I wanted to ask one question. Anybody remember what Hyksos means? The shepherd kings is what it translates to. So taking into consideration everything that was looked at and taken into value tonight about our occupation, our responsibility to be able to know, to look at the one that points in the direction on which we should go so we can draw near to the Father, so that way we know how to properly shepherd the lives that we're responsible for. But I'm thankful for each and every one of y'all. I love y'all. Shabbat shalom.